Hey, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of Modern Day Philosophers. I hope you guys are doing well. I'm sorry it's been a minute since the last one. My computer broke and I had to send it back to the main robots at Apple, but it is fixed and we're back up and running. I want to say thank you to everybody who's emailed me and sent in donations. I don't mention everybody by name on the show. I will if you want me to, but I do thank everybody personally, and I appreciate it more than you know. More than you. How could you know? How could you know? But even if you knew, it would be more than that. And if you make a donation of $20 or more, you will get a pair of complimentary tweaked audio earbuds sent to your home. So to donate to the show, go to moderndayphilosophers.net and click the donate button and help a brother out. I could use the help, please. We don't have a sponsor today, so, you know, I could really use the help. But I do want to tell you about another podcast that I stumbled upon that I think you might find interesting. I like to recommend things when I find them and I like them. The name of the podcast is The Partially Examined Life. It's a funny group of guys going deep into philosophy texts each episode. They all read something by Kant or Plato or Nietzsche or one of those guys, and then they explain it and they give a critique. So if you want to learn more philosophy, I know I give you some here, but there's a lot more out there. You can go and listen to these guys. It's a different kind of thing than this, but I think if you're interested in this, you might also be interested in that. So check out the Partially Examined Life podcast, too. They seem like really good guys, and I enjoyed listening to their show this week. And I'm going to be on a future episode. I'm also going to be at the Joke Joint in St. Paul, Minnesota. If you're near the Twin Cities, I'm there May 28th through the 31st. So please come out and see me. I'd love to meet you. I'd love if you came out to the show. That would be fantastic. You could go to jokejointcomedyclub.com, or it's actually shop.jokejointcomedyclub.com, and you can get tickets. Get tickets. Come and see me. What else are you going to get to see me there? I don't know. I think the sale on this is over. You get the idea. Come and see me if you can. Okay. Today's episode, I talked to Eddie Brill. Eddie Brill's a fascinating guy. For many years, he booked the David Letterman show. He booked all the comedians, all the comic talent for the David Letterman show. He also lost over 100 pounds in the last year or so by switching his diet, and we talk a lot about that. It's a pretty cool conversation. He's got a lot of great advice on in terms of eating, in terms of nutrition, and we get into all that kind of stuff. Well, I'll just let you listen to it. Here it is, my talk with Eddie Brill right after the intro song. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
All right, I'm here with my good friend Eddie Brill in the Lobel House Production Studio, which is my upstairs.
I see.
This is your new voice, I understand.
Yes, I had surgery on my voice. It's very odd to listen to it because it's actually richer and deeper than before. You know, I work a lot, and I love to work, and I force my voice, and I thought I had laryngitis, and I did the warm-up at Letterman and did comedy shows every night. And my voice was scratchy, and then it became laryngitis, and then it was 2 weeks of laryngitis, and then I even went against my rules and had steroids, you know, that stuff that fixed my voice, and that didn't work, so I ended up having surgery. Mm-hmm. The doctor was one of the best in the world at it, and he said, it's the biggest polyp I've ever seen. I don't know how you were able to actually perform. So we did the surgery. You know, I couldn't talk for a week, which was weird, because I'm a chatterbox. And then the week after, I can only talk 15 minutes an hour, which is weird because I call people up and say, all right, you have 15 minutes. Let's get this in. Uh-huh. And then I had to wait a whole hour to have another conversation. And finally, a week ago today, I was able to really talk. And it was hard at first because it was a little tentative. But now I'm on stage and dancing and singing and feel good. And actually, it sounds to me better because I've had lessons with my throat.
This is the first post-polyp interview.
Post-polyp, Peter Piper.
Post-polyp podcast.
Right, podcast. That's the big word.
It's the first
the Lobel House Productions.
Yeah.
And used to talk more like this, yeah. You know, and I had a different accent. And
it's almost like a new guy, right?
Yeah, it's a different guy, and I'm taller, and it's nice.
Sounds like Fred Stoller.
that was it. Okay. I thought that was Bud Harrelson.
Okay.
I don't even know what that is.
I don't know who that is.
He was a shortstop for the Mets when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Bud Harrelson.
Well, are you a Mets fan?
Yeah. They won the World Series on my birthday when I was 11, which was very exciting.
I grew up near Shea Stadium.
Flushing?
In Flushing, yeah. And as a result, I wound up hating the Mets.
Because of all the traffic?
No, it was just always, anytime we go to a baseball game, I have to sit there to watch the local team lose.
Yeah.
Again and again. And everybody had so much pride about it. I said, well, they're a lousy team. I don't know why I'm supposed to support them just because they're local. So
you were born too late. Like in my era, the Mets were just starting. And then there was the World's Fair. And they opened up Shea Stadium at the same time at the World's Fair in 64.
Well, that's more exciting, yeah.
So it was very exciting. And then the Mets won the World Series the same year that the New York Knicks won the championship and the Jets won the Super Bowl.
Do you believe that there's some connectivity in the universe?
I hope so, because I like the feeling I get when there is some kind of connectivity. People say things happen for a reason. I don't know if they happen for a reason. Some things might happen for a reason. You know, one thing leads into another. But I kind of like the randomness sometimes of things happening. Mm-hmm. I remember I moved to Florida when I was a little kid. I was born in Brooklyn. And I wrote a diary that day and kept it for a little bit. But I remember the date always because it was on the first page and I'd open it up. It was big letters and numbers. It was August 23rd, 1970. And then I went to school in Florida and junior high school. I went to college in Boston. I taught in the summer in school. Moved to New York and I'm driving my U-Haul. And as I'm driving down, I realized it was August 23rd, 1980. Mm-hmm. So without planning it, I moved to New York 10 years to the day. And the moment I realized that, my heart started pumping like crazy and I had to pull over the side of the road. I'm like, that's freakish. Yeah. So those kind of things that happen are kind of cool. So, you know, there's some weird things that do happen. So I'm never going to question if there's connectivity.
Do you think the reason things happen is usually good? Like, even if you don't understand it at the time, can you look back at your life and say, oh, that didn't seem like a good thing at the time, but it turned out to be?
Yeah, I think that's happened a few times. I think if you pay, it's, you know, I think things are so abstract, like, you know, religion, not religion itself, but like God or whatever, the connectivity of how the world came, the Big Bang or whatever it is. And it's too abstract for us, our brains, to kind of figure out. So I don't try to figure them out. I just kind of leave it up to that theory of things are so abstract. So when they do happen, it's kind of cool. And when you can see the connection, it's really nice. But how many different things are happening because I made a left instead of making a right? Or I was pissed off that something worked out the way it did. And then it turns out to be the greatest thing that ever happened in my life. I look at life like an EKG machine. You know, if you take risks, you're going to be successful or you're going to fail. You're going to be successful or fail. But if you look at an EKG machine, that means you're alive. But if you don't take any risks, you're flatlining. Yeah. So in order to be able to get that up and down, you need the time, you need the experience. Like I remember when I didn't get a half hour comedy special on Comedy Central and other people had gotten before me, I was kind of like, what's that about? I'm pretty good at this and I've been doing it for years. And I'm, you know, but I was glad in a way because when I did do it, I was much better at the time. But now I look back, I wish I had, you know, even years of experience because I it's hard for me to watch my half hour special because of the mistakes I made back then.
Yeah, I have that with my CD, with my album, which is only 3 years ago, but I can't listen to it. But again, I've talked about this on the show. If somebody else says it's no good, I get very upset.
Right.
But I'm allowed to be critical.
Of course.
For a while, I used to, I don't want to put anything out because it's not good enough. I don't want to put anything out. I don't want to put anything out. And then finally, I forced myself to put the CD out because I thought it'd be good enough. And then I immediately regretted it.
Right.
I thought it's not good enough. And then I realized, if Van Gogh would never have done his early work, he never would have done his later work.
Right.
So you have to put out some...
You have to have your I have both ears period.
Yeah. You need some two-eared work. You know, you have to have that special that you're not proud of.
Right.
Because what are we trying to trick the world, that we go from nothing to genius?
Yeah.
You have to develop. And I think that's kind of fun. When I look back at comedians who I love, like Jim Carrey, and I look at early clips of him, and I say, okay, well, there's hope for me, and I can also see the talent there,
right,
even though it's not as amazing as the later stuff.
I did a showcase last night at the Ice House in Pasadena, and there was one kid who went on. I just knew he has talent. He's not developed as a comedian. You could see he's doing early stand-up mistakes, acting like a comedian, doing easy bits, sort of making fun of people less fortunate than he is to get the laugh. But But you could see that he has that soul. You know, people judge us as comedians from when they saw us, maybe even earlier on in our careers. You know, there was definitely times when I was pandering to the audience, especially in my Comedy Central special. A lot of pandering, a lot of easier material, wanting to please the audience, wanting them to love me. And then I realized years later, watching Pryor and Bill Hicks, that it was that's the opposite of what we should be doing. We should be doing what really matters to us. And now I just go out there and do what I do with, I'm, you know, I still get pleased by the laughter or the, you know, but it's more I'm doing what I want to do.
It's and then not I'll as, see, as needy in a way. Is what
yeah, because, you know, there are people out there, you see them come out there and love me, please, you know, and it's...
It's at the core of it all. But the good thing is when you're able to... I think at the core of all of us, it's love me, because that's what the laughs
yes.
are.
Yes.
It, whether we're making profound statements or enlightened ideas.
Or it's, silly, it's, you know, silly walks or, you
it's,
know.
It's still under love the me. Under the umbrella of love me.
Yes.
But I think at a certain point where you're like, love me if you want.
Right. And love me for who I am.
I'm not going to force it on you. That's the big distinction. It's like here, I'm not going to... be to you what you want me to be. This is what I am. I hope you love me, but if you don't, I'll find another group of people that will.
Right.
And that's the difference, I think. That's the security where you're like, you hit a point where enough people have loved you and you're like, all right, now I can be discriminating about who loves me.
It's true. It's exactly right. Again, it's that, you know, like if you're going on a date and you're desperate and you're just over the top and love me,
right.
scare people away.
Yeah.
But the more you, you know, are not that person, the other person wants you even more. And I've even told people who want to audition for me or for when I audition for things is to have these sort of attitude like, fuck Eddie Brill. What does he know? Mm-hmm. I'm going to go up there, do what I do. And if he likes it, great. If he doesn't, somebody else will.
What attracted you to that part of what you do?
You know, as a kid, I was an adult at 15. I raised kids, my brothers and sister. And I loved it. And I loved helping people. I really did. I've always been this sort of caretaker. And I really get into it. And then I started teaching. You know, you can't teach comedy, but I was teaching different kinds of things, interpersonal communications and different kinds of things like that. I helped form the first comedy writing department in America in a college when I was at Emerson. And we were forced to be teachers, Dennis Leary and myself and some other people. And we realized that we learned a lot more from teaching. So I started doing workshops, you know, because again, even Rickles says, I saw the picture of Rickles there, he says, you can't learn comedy. So what I did was I made everyone a teacher in these workshops and we'd be mm-hmm. each other's eyes and ears. So it was really fun. And then I was moving to New York and an opportunity came for me to run a comedy club. It was called The Paper Moon, 1984, July. And I met Colin Quinn right away, and we sort of ran this little comedy room.
And that's and what it, became the Boston Comedy Club.
Eventually,
right?
Yeah. We got moved upstairs. And it was kind of fun to book comedians because you were creating these shows with the best of the best. And the lineups in those days, you know, were Stephen Wright and... you know, Paula Poundstone and Susie Essman and Mario Cantone, people we knew and who weren't in the cliques in the other clubs in New York. So it was really a good feeling. But then it got over the top where people were, every gig I went to, everyone was my best friend and everyone wanted to be booked. And I saw that animal. And it's funny because I understand it because I'm a comedian and I want to do the same thing.
Have you been able to distinguish over the years who are your friends with that are genuinely your friends outside of what they need?
Yes. And it becomes really clear because you can really see that. There are people who introduce you like, here's my friend Eddie Brill from the Letterman show, you know, instead of here's my friend Eddie Brill. But, you know, and very rarely am I fooled by people. I can tell when people are genuine because here I am being a comedian. I think comedians can sense that genuineness, that authenticity between each other.
Yeah.
And it's pretty great.
Yeah, you have to sort of be tapped into that in order to be able to be a great comedian.
I think so.
I think that's the only thing we are doing is trying to distinguish phoniness from what's real.
Yes. So it actually works. I've been in rooms where comedians have never gotten the chance to be in there. Like for the Aspen Comedy Festival, I was on the board and I'm sitting with all of the, and there were terrific people, all of the casting directors, CBS, ABC, NBC, Fox, and discussing people's careers. And I saw how it worked. And I saw how they were how, especially American television, how they care more for style over substance. And I'd fight for comedians because I was one, or am one. I still think I am one more than ever now. And I'd go, but this person is just handsome or pretty. Why? But, you know, it's like I always think of Ricky Gervais, who's one of the greatest. He came up with the greatest sitcom in the history of sitcoms, The Original Office. Would Ricky Gervais have gotten the job if he auditioned for it in the United States? Maybe not.
I'm fascinated by these times that you find yourself on the other side of the business. Do you feel just as comfortable on both sides, or do you feel like, I don't belong here, I'm a comic, I'm secretly here like a spy?
I felt that at the beginning, like, you know, what am I doing here? But I loved it. It was kind of fun because I try to make a positive scenario. At the beginning, I made mistakes because I had never done that before. Mm-hmm. Booked a comedy club, and I had to say no to people, and I always wanted to be loved, you know, just like any comic. And I had to tell people no, and they didn't like it, and they, you know, would hate you or say, you know, people project their fears onto you. So if they're not really good and you don't book them, it's not their fault or not the lack of work on their part. It's you suck because you're the gatekeeper, mm-hmm. quote unquote, in there. So it was a little weird at first, but I just learned that I want as a comedian, I want someone to just tell me the truth. Don't bullshit me. Just say, look, you know, I book mostly young alternative comics and you're an old man. And there's nothing wrong with it, but this is how I do it. Fine, I'm not going to argue with you. Mm-hmm. So it was a little weird at the beginning. And once I was just honest, I said, look, I have to be comfortable with myself. I'm honest with people. Most of the time they want to hear it. If they don't want to hear it, it's fine. There's nothing I can do. It's the weird part is being hated by certain people. It's really weird to, you know, I've heard a couple of things where people have made stuff up about me just because they can't come to terms with the fact that they just weren't right for the booking of the show, which is the only weird part. But it's I kind of enjoy it, but I don't think of myself as a booker. I think of myself as a comedian who has some very cool other jobs.
When these people irrationally hate you.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
There's a woman named Gail Blanke, and her name is funny. That's why I always remember it. And she's one of the most brilliant people I've ever met in my life. And we talked a lot. We became friends. She was, you know, about 20 years older than I was. But, you know, so she was like a mom figure because my mom was 20 years different. And she said to me, because we talked about this, and she said, starve the negative and feed the positive. And I said, what do you mean? She says, well, you know, if you have a negative scenario and you don't give it oxygen, then it starts to lose its breath and dies. She said, but remember this, that when you starve something or you strangle something, it will kick out the hardest just before it dies. So as you're starving this negativity, it's going to really come at you hard at the end. And just remember to let it go. No matter how hard it comes at you, no matter what angle it tries to talk you into not getting it out. And it really hit home. And so I've kind of starved the negativity. You know, less than a handful of comedians have written nasty letters to me because I didn't book them. And some people were like stalking me negative. And there's one person who just made me angry all the time. And I just learned from her to just stop it. So instead of writing back and trying to make sense with this person, I just stopped. And that person kept writing and writing. And the more I didn't write, the more they wrote back and was more negative and more evil. And then finally they just stopped writing because I didn't give that person oxygen anymore. And they went away. And that's how you have to do it. You just have to realize that not everyone's going to love you, even if, even if your intentions are really great. I think my intentions are great. I think the love quotient in my life, I'm very blessed to have the biggest love quotient compared to the negative in the scenario that I've been in as far as someone who can help other people. And the people that I've helped in my life have been, there's a huge amount of people that I've given opportunities to. And young men and women who I've, you know, still to this day, I will give them the time and write them back and talk to them on the phone. And I'm still going through sets. I have about 120 sets in my email box that's in a separate folder that every day I'll go through one or two, call the person, write the person, say, here's what I believe, whatever. I really enjoy that part of it. I'm a better comic because of it. So that's the positivity that I keep feeding the oxygen to in my life. And the other parts, what are you going to do? You're not, you know, when life is over, You just hope you have more in the plus column than you do in the minus column.
Yeah.
Okay.
I know that in the past, you've talked to me quite a bit about your journey, I guess, with nutrition and something that you've been very passionate about. Are you still doing a raw food diet?
Well, it was only raw food completely at the beginning, when I weighed close to 400 pounds, I wanted to cut out all sugars and to start a path to health. And, you know, you don't really need to be all raw. Plus, there's some deficiencies in being all raw, like B12 and other kinds of minerals and vitamins that you don't get. And the body can use some hot food, like the spleen supposedly needs warmth in order for it to be at its best peak. I've learned so much. It's crazy. I lost 135 pounds. My skin changed to where I had all these marks and you know, weird eczema and stuff like that. And my hair got thicker and my skin got better. And I just had more energy than I've ever had in my life. And now that I learned this, I just wanted to get on a mountaintop and say, we're all being lied to every day. You know, when you were told by this company that this is good, it really isn't good. And they just trying to get you to buy their product. That's human nature.
That's that bullshit detector in you too. That's the comic saying, I found some bullshit, everybody. Look.
But food is such a religion to everyone that it's hard to tell people. So when I was actually screaming at people at the beginning, it turned them off. But so I'd learned to just be an example. If you want to become a millionaire or a billionaire, the way to do it is get people addicted to what you're selling. Because they're addicted, there is no way you can't be a billionaire. The other part is if your stuff is dangerous that will kill people, you have to change the formula so that you kill them slowly. Because if you kill them quickly, then your product's taken off the market. So there are products out there that are toxic. Recently, you know, one of those sandwich companies finds out there's sneaker rubber in the bread. Or you find out that, you know, in one of the energy drinks, it's full of flame retardant. Because it's just cheaper to make. It's you get the desired effect that you need, and you make billions more money. So it becomes greed over compassion. But here's something that Gail Blanke lady taught me about starving the negativity. I said to her, the reason why I'm overweight and the reason why I'm not taking care of myself is I help everybody else but myself. And she says, that's bullshit. She said, it's a bullshit equation. That doesn't mean, one thing doesn't mean the other. You're a person, you take care of yourself as well. You be one of the people you take care of. And I went, oh, okay. And then it just clicked and I went, okay, so I'll start taking care of myself.
Where do you think it comes from, this wanting to take care of people?
When I was 15, my stepfather got cancer and I was the oldest of five and the youngest brother was just born. So I became his father, Chase Stiper, took him to school, you know, PTA meetings, my other twin brothers, my sister was 11. She was a little older, but the twins are three and my brother was just born. And I was in charge of these people's lives and my own, and I really enjoyed it. I got such a thrill out of being able to make an influence on these little kids and be a positive influence because of it. And I think that's really where it goes back to. So I went to learn about health. I went to learn about nutrition. It's, again, me being the caretaker.
Well, that's the connection between you and the philosopher that Alex picked out for you. We're going to talk about a guy named Peter Singer. He's still alive. He's 67. Born July 6th, 1946. He is a philosopher of food and farming. Peter Singer agrees with the idea that farming is utilitarian. Utilitarianism is the moral pursuit of finding the greatest good for the most people, taking into account that we may have to hurt others to achieve this.
Because think about it. If, say, we all realized that soda was bad for us, which it is, we'd have to fire everyone at the soda company. Millions and millions of people who are relying on soda to feed their kids and to do all this stuff, you know, they'd have to lose their jobs. We would hurt a lot of people if fast food restaurants went away. You know, you have to hurt people, like you said, for the greater good.
Singer says, however, that suffering of animals must be taken into account because they think and feel the way we can, so we cannot neglect their suffering. Singer rejects the idea of rights, meaning that living things have entitlement to, well, that's what Carlin always talked about,
yes,
rights,
right.
To good treatment just because it would be nice, but says that a living creature has weight in our moral calculation, and it's unfair to discount animals when thinking of our own benefit. In contrast to Tom Regan, who believes that we should care for animals because they have rights. He's known in particular for his book, Animal Liberation, which was published in 1975, a canonical text in animal rights liberation theory.
Good bully for him. You know, when I first got healthy, you know, I wasn't thinking so much about the animals and their rights. But as the more I started doing it, the more I realized, you know, I always loved animals. My whole life I've had every pet you can ever have. I've had, you know, fish and birds and dogs and cats and lizards and turtles and
on. Yeah.
And I love them. But I would still eat and say, well, I don't want to know how it's made. I just want to enjoy that delicious chicken. But then you realize how chicken is, even in the United States, 90%+ of the chickens are not really chickens anymore. They're created like in a laboratory.
Right.
And they're full of hormones and stuff that you would, you know, you'd suspend a baseball player for. and, you know, it's just because there's such a demand for chicken, and you can take chemicals and you can change the way something tastes, because it really would taste awful if you ate it the way it's created. But if you take chemicals and you camouflage them, same thing with a French fry from a fast food company. There are some that are more popular than others, and those are only because the chemical combination is created to work your brain to make you be in love with that taste. Like pigs, for instance, are some of the smartest creatures on the planet. And if they know they're going to die, their meat will sour because they
really?
So you have to kind of fool them. And when you throw them into the burning vat of hot water to kill them, I mean, bacon is amazing. Even in my vegan, become a vegan, you know, there's no denying the smell of bacon is amazing. And, you know, in the years I've put bacon on things, it's just been great. Or just cook up a whole thing of bacon. Now I've learned to have sort of a burger that's made out of mushrooms. The cheese is made from like nuts, like cashews, and the bacon is sort of a crispier eggplant. And I still get the same effect of the great taste and the texture, but it's more delicious because it's real food. And I'm not killing a very smart pig who shouldn't be killed.
Yeah, these pigs could be doing big things.
Yeah, they can run the podcast, and all we have to do is show up.
Yeah, there's so much. You know, I've never eaten bacon. I'm raised Orthodox Jewish, and I.
Gotcha.
It's funny because I did an audition yesterday for bacon flavored Ritz crackers, and I had to talk about how I love the taste of bacon. I had this ethical dilemma whether or not I should even do this, because I thought, what if I get the part and then I'm out there selling bacon? It's the most disingenuous thing.
But you're not selling bacon,
but
because
the
it's
flavor,
not real. You're the flavor that's created to make it taste like what bacon smells like.
Right. So I'm selling chemicals.
You're selling chemicals.
And I thought, okay.
I'm all right with that.
It's deadly anyway. But
it's all deadly.
So
we're all going to die, you know, and people say, well, everything's in moderation. And that's true in some cases, but there are things like getting hit in the head with a lead pipe. You don't even want it once.
Right.
You don't want it once. And the same thing with putting toxins in your body. When I went 90 days without any sugars, fake or real, and went back to real sugars only, the taste of the food, the real food, was so delicious. You know, like if we go to a fast food place, there's no nutrition in it. The reason we eat is to get nutrition. So if you eat this burger, it's a waste of a meal, because
right.
there's nothing in it that helps. It only makes your body work overtime to sort of break it down. And it never breaks down. So you have to really hurt yourself to get it through your body. The reason why there's such a big obesity problem in the world is because people are malnourished. So they're never getting the nourishment that the body craves. So when they're done with a meal, they're looking for, the body's going, hey, buddy, where's the meal that I'm waiting for? And we will eat and eat and eat until we get satisfied or fall asleep and then wake up and do another round of that craziness.
And I think it goes back to the government owning us. The FDA approves these drugs basically because the government is saying it's okay. And when you're talking about people dying slowly, let's kill them off slowly, I often think to myself, yeah, let's keep them as long as they're able to work and as long as they're able to pay taxes into the system.
Right.
And as soon as they start to get, their bodies start to get old and we can't make as much money off them, let's clear them out of here so that we don't have to take care of them. And we
right.
can accomplish that with the food.
And along the way, we're going to need medications to deal with the symptoms, not with the cure. Because most pharmaceuticals deal with symptoms. So when people feel like they have diabetes, you can get rid of type 2 diabetes in almost 100% of the time in 5 days to 2 weeks by changing your diet. But people don't want to change their diet because we're so addicted to our diet. So what they do is they give us medication to help us deal with the symptoms of diabetes and get us through. And then the government's making a lot of money because the politicians are being funded by these major corporations. But as a comedian, I've done a million corporate shows for these chemical companies. And I've done, like you're doing the ad for the bacon flavored, you know,
I don't know if I got it.
Right. Yeah. I hope you do. You know, and I've done it and I'm just as guilty as anybody else. You know, I want to pay my bills and, you know, our life is based on money and based. And so, like, for instance, the FDA approves certain items that are, you know, sort of safe. Like you can call anything natural, even if it's not. You can call something organic if 20% of it is not organic, which means it's not organic. If you have pesticides in something, and in the word pesticide is killing pests, well, don't you think that's going to kill us too? Slower mm-hmm. than it's going to kill the pest.
Right.
But in that situation, if you allow pesticides, then it's not organic. You know, you go to a store and you go to the grocery store like Ralph's, and there's 1,000 apples and they're all the exact same size and they fit really nice in a pyramid and they're easy to stack.
Yeah.
And there's no taste whatsoever to it except the chemical taste that sort of sets our brain like, okay, we're having something good. And then I did a gig in Paris, and across the street there was a fruit stand and all the fruit was misshapen and whatever. And I took a bite into this peach and it was like, oh my God, this is what it's really supposed to be like.
Ah, a peach. This is a peach.
I have a peach. Son of a peach.
In Paris, the peaches taste like peaches.
The beaches taste like peaches. So
every time you get a French person in America, they just walk around complaining about everything.
What the fuck is with your peaches? It's like, why do you have this Brooklyn accent? Because when I come to your country, I change my accent like you do when you come to Oz.
Maybe they just had a polyp in their throat.
Ah. It's all comes back.
It's a different voice. I got a new voice. Imagine if that's it. If the French just had polyps in their throats
all the time.
They have them removed and they sound like Brooklyn people.
They never liked Jerry Lewis. It just sounded like they liked Sherry Lewis all this time. It's like, oh, it was polyps. We just didn't understand it.
This country is, it's different, you know?
Fucking A.
I got to tell you, you know, it's not. All right. Here's a little bit of Peter Singer's philosophy, if you don't mind reading a bit.
From here?
Yeah.
How far down the evolutionary scale shall we go? Shall we eat fish? What about shrimps? Oysters? To answer these questions, we must bear in mind the central principle on which our concern for other beings is based. The only legitimate boundary to our concern for the interests of others being of other beings is the point at which it is no longer accurate to say that the other being has interests. To have interests, in a strict, non-metaphorical sense, a being must be capable of suffering or experiencing pleasure. If a being suffers, there can be no moral justification for disregarding that suffering or for refusing to count it equally with the like suffering of any other being. But the converse of this is also true. If a being is not capable of suffering or of enjoyment, there is nothing to take into account. Okay. Well, for me, it's true. I mean, we will kill an animal for our pleasure. And, you know, I've always wondered, people who kill things, how do you live your life knowing you've killed something? Like, you know, you go to a war and you kill somebody. I mean, you're doing it to protect the interest of the oil companies, or you're killing someone because you really believe that our country would be a better country. And that happens, both cases happen. How can you come back to society after you've killed someone, or, you know, and feel like, you know, I'm a good person, you know, I'm, you know, like you're in your religion, if you killed somebody, that, you know, in any religion, you're taught thou shalt not kill. And then you go and kill and you come back and you have to be like, la, 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 I killed people, but it was just for a reason. Same thing with animals. You know, why is it good to kill an animal? Why is it good to watch them suffer?
As you're saying all this, I'm thinking about how it takes death to sustain life.
Hmm. Yeah.
Whether it's a plant's death or an animal's death, something has to die for something else to live. That's a weird thing.
Yeah. You know, I'm 55 now. I've only become a vegan 3.5 years ago. And for all those years, I'm a great cook, and I make an incredible steak dinners and chicken. And I would go fishing, catch a fish, never cared about killing them, watch them die, and then take them home, slice them up, and make the most delicious fish dish you'll ever have in your life. And I loved it for years. And I understand why people do it. But now that I've learned the truth, and the truth makes sense, you put good things in your body, good things will happen. You don't put toxins, you detox your body, then the organs in your body work well.
Let's take a look at some of our quotes here from Peter Singer.
Okay. All the arguments to prove man's superiority cannot shatter this hard fact. In suffering, the animals are our equals. Yeah. I mean, you know, you kill an animal, you kill a person, it still sucks.
Yeah.
It still sucks. Yeah. It's still bad to kill. It's not our right to kill. No one deserves to have pain and suffering unless they bring it on themselves.
I think this philosophy is really true until it comes down to there's a drowning dog and a drowning kid.
Mm.
And then all of a sudden, who do you save? You're going to save the kid.
Right.
So at that point, I kind of feel like all this goes out the window. It's just sort of like chatter. It's like, yeah, in theory, we're all suffering in equals, but of course we're going to look out for our own first.
Well, what do you think, you know, if there's two kids and one is your son and one is somebody else's kid?
You're going to go for yours.
Right.
Right. Unless the other kid's way better
looking. Way cooler and going to make you a lot of money, and your kid's just a loser who's going to just weigh you down.
Unless you hate your kid.
Yeah. The two of you are going to push, you and the other kid, you're going to push your kid down to the ground.
Unless you threw your kid in there and then you're like, Billy, my neighbor's kid.
This is crazy, but I love him. But what if it's two kids that are not your own and you can only save one? How do you make that decision?
Mm.
You know, in those situations, you're going to go with your instinct is to save your own.
Right.
Your own family. You know, I'm looking out for my family, number one, always. You know, but sometimes a situation comes like you want to help other people. You want if it's two animals, you're going to try to save them both. If you can't, you pick one you could save, the one that you're not going to think, okay, well, you know, here's a pig and the pig is smart and here's a goat and the goat's not as smart. I'll go for the pig. I think the key is to really be good to yourself and be an example for others. And sometimes, and instincts always tell the truth. Instincts never lie. It's us realizing what our instincts are. And if our instincts are to save your kid over somebody else's kid, that's just the way your instincts work. Mm-hmm. Same thing with a kid over an animal. That's how your human instinct works. Instincts will always win.
It fascinates me that people determine guilt over killing based on how intelligent the creature is. None of these, we talked about a pig being intelligent.
Right. Over a chicken that maybe is not intelligent. But
what's the pig going to accomplish in its life with its intelligence that the chicken's not going to... It's not going to...
The chicken's going to cross the road and get hit by a car. The pig's going to go, wait a second, a car's coming.
The pig is not going to figure out a cure for cancer because it's more intelligent.
That's right.
Well, what is this thing that people are...
Well, we figured out the cure for a lot of cancers, but we won't put them into play because they'll, you know, people will lose a lot of money.
Do we have one more quote? I think we have one more quote.
Okay, let's see. Oh, okay. The notion that human life is sacred just because it is human life is medieval. So again, he's saying the same kind of thing. It's about, you know, humans, we think we're better than others and, you know, screw the suffering of others. We're humans, we're in charge. We can use all our fingers and we can, you know, make phone calls and we know how to, you know, play Monopoly and all that stuff, and we're cooler. And the truth is, we're all cool. You know, the animals are cool, the plants are cool, the life is all right, and if you treat everyone well and you don't eat all the... If it ended up in our society where we didn't eat the animals, we'd be really healthy. We'd really be a good place. It's not going to be that way. It's too much... Again, the game is rigged, and it's going to be really hard to change that. You can know that in your heart, that it would really be good if most people had a chance to do well. And if the people on the bottom who were taking advantage of the system and the people at the top who are taking advantage of the system, if those people can be incarcerated for being such assholes.
Sometimes I get jealous of the guys in jail because they don't have to worry about rent.
Well, that's going back to Monopoly.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes when you're broke, it's almost a blessing when you get that role that puts you in jail. It's like, whew.
Yeah. Okay. Free food, free rent, free health care.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
All right. What'd I do right? Nothing. You did everything
you're
wrong.
In jail. Yeah. Bend over.
When you try to do right, you get fucked. when you do wrong, you get fucked in a different way. But it's just
it's all fucking.
Yeah, either you're getting fucked financially, but not fucked physically, or you're getting fucked physically, but not taken care of financially.
That's right. And I think that was one of Peter Singer's quote. He said, "You know, don't fuck animals." No, he didn't say that at all.
I apologize to the listeners. I guess there's a gardener,
and he has a mask on his face. The gardener. He's mowing the lawn. He's doing a good job, though.
Yeah.
But he has a mask because he doesn't want to get all that Roundup.
Right.
You know, he doesn't want to get all the chemicals that are in the lawn.
Because of the non-vegans buried beneath it. If only everybody was vegan.
Yeah, if everybody, the
gardeners wouldn't need masks.
Yeah.
It's like a hippie kind of song.
Everybody who's not a vegan would be better off. They were dead and they were buried deep down in the ground. No, that's not the song.
I want to die with no toxins in my body.
Just as long as I die.
So the gardener at the cemetery doesn't need to wear a mask.
His task would be better.
This is one of the worst
songs ever. We'd never do well at song making up in the moments.
This is not the moment where Danny and Eddie figured out that they should drop comedy and become a...
Let's compartmentalize that out of our lives.
Eddie, it's always a pleasure to have
you here. It's always been a pleasure, and it's fun to just talk I learned a lot from hearing myself, and I learned a lot from the questions that you asked, and I hope that it was good for you as well.
Oh, it was good for me too.
Yay! Dan.
All right, thanks, Eddie.
All right, everybody, that's it. Another delightful episode of Modern Day Philosophers. Thank you to my guest, Eddie Brill. Thank you guys for listening. The website's moderndayphilosophers.net. You can make a donation. You could find out more info on the guests. You can scroll through the pictures that are up there and whatever else. ModernDayPhilosophers.net. Send a donation of $20 or more, and I will not only be very grateful, but I'll also send you a free tweaked audio earbud to your house. And not just one, both of them for both ears. Okay, but one unit. You get it. All right. That's it. That's everything. Go to iTunes. Leave 5 stars and a nice rating, a nice comment. I'd appreciate that a lot. And I'd always, always love to hear from you at thecomical@yahoo.com. That's my email address. And I will write you back. And I'll be grateful that you wrote me. And that's about it. Thanks, everybody, and have a great week. Bye-bye.